Hey guys, let me tell you about some of the new scents you can pick up over at Fable Beard Company, the official beard products of the American History Podcast. It's July, it's the height of summer, and what's better than some patriotic products like one of their latest creations, the American Soaring Freedom. The scent profile of this one is smoked gunpowder, aged woods, light cologne, and vanilla musk. Or perhaps you'd prefer the slugger. Nothing says summertime like baseball. This one features a profile of cracked cedar baseball bats, warm tobacco leaves, and cracker jacks. I just got this one a week ago, and it's quickly moving up my list of favorites. So head on over to fablebeardco.com and get yourself some of the best products you can find for your beard or even the hair on your head. As always, they come in a beard oil, beard butter, beard wash, and a conditioner. And the conditioner is so good, I actually use it on my dogs, and I tell you, their fur has never been better. It's never felt better, and it's never looked better. And of course, don't forget, use coupon code SHAWN15 for 15% off each and every single order. That's SHAWN, the number 15. Okay, let's get into the show.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
Okay, so Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks, glad to be here.
Awesome, so let's do this. This is a really fascinating book, and so I'm just going to jump right into this. How did the idea for this book come about?
Well, several years ago, my colleague and friend, Tom Mayday, with whom I had done a book project many years ago, basically called me up, and he's a professional photographer, and he said, I need something new. I need a new project. He said, you know, he lives in Chicago. I've been walking by the Stephen Douglas Monument in Chicago, which is pretty impressive. He said, why don't we do a book about people who ran for president and lost and the monuments to them?
Yes.
He said, if nothing else, we won't have any competition. So I said, that sounds like a fun project. I could use something different as well. So, and that was that.
That's a really fascinating story. And I really like that. I just, you know, when I first got this book, and I mean, the people that lost a presidential election, you know, it's, I don't want to say losers, but the also-rans, and I think that term is kind of not the best term either, but I mean, you know, they lost.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole book about them, many of whom have kind of been forgotten.
Yeah. And they were so prominent during that day too, which is interesting.
That's right. So now in the introduction, and I've actually met Michael Dukakis on one occasion back when I was in high school. Dating myself here, he was running for president, and I was a high school journalist, and I got to ask him a question, and it was great. So I'm not gonna say he's my friend or anything, but it was great that I could meet him, and he does the intro. And I wanted to start off with kind of an abstract question about a statement he makes. He says, "What's the role of, or my question is, what is the role of memory, or as he calls it, public memory, in American life?" It seems like that's a major theme, you know, throughout this book.
Oh, yeah. And it touched upon a lot in the introduction, is that, you know, when you look at monuments, you're looking at the what have traditionally been the primary repositories for, you know, public memory, how we remember, who remember, what should we remember, how should we remember them. And when we began the book, it was somewhat of an academic topic. Mm-hmm. There weren't many people interested in it. And towards the end of the final months of preparing the book, it suddenly become front page news. You know, that statue was being taken down. That building was being renamed. There was all sorts of conversations going on about why we remember people in a certain way. So the idea that was who we are is defined about how we remember, and which is something that Tom and I both understood at the beginning of the book. And so we were, you know, pleased to see that there was a conversation around this very important topic. Because, you know, I think there was a period when Americans gave a lot of thought to monuments.
Mm-hmm.
And then as, you know, new forms of media appeared, statues and monuments didn't seem as important anymore, and they kind of moved away from that.
Yeah.
But you know, the new medias didn't really have that same gravitas. So, right. you know, you didn't get as impressive memorials. I mean, occasionally you get a building or a really big statue, but it was kind of a lost art, I think, reserved for only a handful of people. Where in earlier days, you didn't have to be world famous in order to get a statue.
Right.
So, you know, again, and a good example would be from the book would the John Calhoun College at Yale.
Mm-hmm.
That being renamed was, again, really, I think, a significant moment and a good moment overall, because, again, it was worth considering, you know, how it's one thing to remember someone.
Yeah.
It's another thing to honor their memory.
Exactly.
And some people, the balance of the book, they are complicated. They did some good in their life and they did some bad in their life. And how do you weigh it? You know, at the time that Calhoun College was named, the sense was that Calhoun was still a largely positive figure in American life, albeit he spent his last few years being a voice for secession.
Yeah.
But then more recently, we thought, you know, Calhoun represents an ideology that we have thoroughly repudiated, and his effects on reinforcing ideology were baleful. So apart from the brilliant achievements of his early life, should we really be naming a college after him, particularly a college where students of color are going to be attending? So
good question.
It was a legitimate question. It was a serious question. And it spurred, I think, a healthy debate, and it led to a good solution. It's always better that, you know, with monuments and statues, you just take them down. But if you have something that can be legitimately renamed to honor someone else, I think that's a better outcome.
That's a great, very interesting way of looking at it. And I mean, I guess part of me thought about how this book is strangely timely with everything that's been going on. But let's look at something a little more, I guess, I don't know. I was figuring, like, who could we look at first? And so I thought, let's look at Barry Goldwater. Now, he's an interesting character. He lost, for those who don't know, he lost in 1964 to Lyndon Johnson, the senator from Arizona. What can we say about Barry Goldwater? I mean, I wonder, had he won, would Vietnam have been any different? Would he have handled it differently than his opponent? I'm not sure. So just wanted to get your thoughts on another one of these kind of, God, they're all so interesting. So I don't want to just say he's interesting, but sure. He was definitely interesting.
Goldwater was one of those people who is a victim of bad timing.
Yeah.
He was trying to run for president at the apex of the liberal movement's influence in America.
Mm-hmm.
At a time when some people thought that conservatism was in a permanent recession.
Yeah.
That American by and large would be liberal progressive. And you know, when he lost, the idea that 16 years later another conservative would win in a landslide would have been unthinkable. That's how quickly things change. And in the book, you know, I talk about one of Goldwater's interesting, his role really is he's the forerunner. He's like John the Baptist to Jesus,
yeah.
You know. And the other thing about Goldwater was he was not as refined. He was a smart, tough man, but he wasn't as refined and smooth and telegenic as a Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
So apart from the timing, he simply didn't have the ability to attract as many followers as someone like Reagan. He didn't have Reagan's sunny side.
Mm-hmm.
He was tough-minded, responsible, had a lot of common sense, but he was just a particular variety that it was very difficult for him, I think, to really get the net. I don't think there were too many places in the country that would not have been wowed by him. And as it turned out, it was too easy for the opposition to present him as a radical.
Yeah,
you know.
And that's always hard, right? I mean, or hard for you if they're able to paint you, if your opponent is able to paint you as a radical, if some of that stuff starts to stick or whatever they're trying to paint, it's really hard for you to overcome that. Which, you know, people like Reagan, Clinton, Obama, really, I think the term back in Reagan's time was Teflon. You know, yeah. It just nothing would stick to them.
Right.
And it just seems like really great politicians, whether you like them or hate them, they have this ability to, doesn't matter what you try to stick on them, it just doesn't work. Right. So that's an interesting way of looking at it.
You know, the best politicians are, to use the phrase that Franklin Roosevelt describing Al Smith, he said, are happy warriors. They're fighters, but they exude a sense of possibility and can-doism. And those are traits that are very important in America. You know, they may be less important in other countries, which have more pessimistic cultures. Mm-hmm. But Americans like they want their leaders to be sunny on some level. They don't want necessarily to be Pollyanna, but they want them to be upbeat and to inspire them like a football coach. Come on, we're all going to get out there. We're going to fight the good fight. That's what they're looking for. And you know, anyone who comes across as a scold is going to lose points with the American people. But definitely. Goldwater, again, as one of the lions of the Senate, his defeat meant that he would stay in politics longer than the people that rose to the presidency. He was obviously he outlasted Lyndon Johnson. He outlasted Richard Nixon. So Goldwater was the one who told Nixon it was time to go. You know? And the interesting thing, Goldwater was, you know, he was one of the early proponents against removing restrictions for gays in the military.
That's right.
And he said, you don't have to be straight to shoot straight. It's like, let's focus on what the person's actually supposed to do.
Yeah.
That's really the primary thing. If they can do that, then they should be, and again, for a conservative, it's interesting because in the years after Goldwater, conservatism got tied up a lot with the right wing Christianity, and which was an aspect of the movement that Goldwater really despised. He was not someone who really felt that religious ideas should be imposed on other people. He didn't get along with that aspect. That's another thing too. Reagan's victory was that he was able to woo and do a lot of diplomacy with the part of the Republican Party that had become very hyper-religious. Goldwater would have had, I think, very little patience for them, and the relationship wouldn't have worked. Their mutual loathing would have, you know, come across.
Now let's look at, so let's kind of backtrack a little bit, and another guy that's just fascinating to me, and he's kind of a giant in American history, and that is William Jennings Bryan. I mean, wow, he ran and lost, this poor guy, on three separate occasions. And you mentioned something in the book, and I wanted to draw it out. How do we remember him, and is it, what's wrong with the way he is remembered these days?
Well, you know, I say in the book that it's worse than being forgotten is being misremembered.
Yes.
And Bryan, I think, suffers in part from the perception of him that's been shaped by the play Inherit the Wind, where the Bryan stand-in character is a kind of a sad figure. Mm-hmm. A lot of energy, but he's a man who hasn't moved with the times. And that doesn't really capture the essence of Bryan's contribution. And even his fictional counterpart, when he dies in Inherit the Wind, his opponent says there was much greatness in this man. And that's the thing about Bryan. There are traits in him that are easy to make fun of. But he made, I think, a very positive contribution by channeling tremendous anxiety and resentment and fear into a positive political movement. He came of age at a time when agrarian America, which had been the dominant aspect of American culture since the beginning, mm-hmm. was suddenly being overshadowed by the city, the megacities. And the megacities were full of newly arrived immigrants mm-hmm. whose ability to adapt to Americanism was considered suspect by the old-timers. And it could have led to a very ugly, ugly nativism, as it had in the early part of the 19th century. But instead, Bryan channeled it. He said, no, we are, it's about being people of the country and recognizing that we contribute to something. And he says famously, you know, burn down your cities, but our fields and crops will help spring you up again. Burn us down and your cities are toast. So, you know, so we're important, and we have to be remembered and acknowledged in the political equation of the country. And I think, you know, I think if you compare Bryant as like a Donald Trump, in the sense that there was both a large disaffected body of voters that they responded to them. But Bryant was essentially a positive force.
Yes.
It was a positive force, whereas Trump was simply negative because he had no, because Trump doesn't have a larger vision, I think. But Bryant was again, he was a product of American optimism. He would never have given a speech that said American carnage. He would have pointed to problems, but he would have been infused by that. But we can fix this.
Yeah.
Can fix this.
Kind of gets back to that earlier statement about the sunny disposition of a Reagan or a Clinton versus the negative, let's say, of a Goldwater. Now, so another one that I really liked, and it, I guess because I remember him running, and that's Bob Dole. Now, you called him the party elder. Could he have also been kind of the wrong man at the wrong place at the wrong time?
The thing about that, if you're a really good senator, that's a disadvantage in trying to become president, because the qualities of a good senator are not necessarily the products of the qualities of an attractive president. Senators spend their time, you know, doing the important work of moving legislation, staying in committees, reaching across the aisle. Getting party consensus. It's such an essential work, but it's not the kind of work that inspires you to take the bully pulpit. And one of the problems of spending a lot of time in the Senate, I think, is that having spent most of your time in committee work, you're not really ideally suited to really address the world and connect with people in the way that we expect our presidential candidates to be. I think it's interesting. If you contrast the careers of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Ted Kennedy, Ted Kennedy had the longest career of any of them, but he found his real place was in the Senate, where you have to have patience, which is something that neither of his brothers really had, which is why they preferred the presidency and the cabinet and the attorney general's office, where you could simply tell people what to do and get it done. John F. Kennedy was not an outstanding senator during his time there. And Robert F. Kennedy was there for only a few years. And his name is not attached to any significant legislation. It was really seen as really a holding place for a presidential run eventually. But with Dole, the thing that he was too much of a senator to be an attractive presidential candidate. You know, because the Senate shapes you in ways that other political roles don't. I think to aspire to be a president, I think the best preparation is probably being a governor. Probably being a governor, because, you know, you're doing essentially the same roles at a lower level. And if you are going to be a senator who becomes president, you probably shouldn't spend more than 10 years in the Senate or the House of Representatives, because after a while, you're no longer going to be temperamentally suited to be out in front like that.
Yeah.
You know, but I think Dole's great contribution, you know, over the decades was quieter, steadier hand. Again, being able to reach across the aisle because he was respected as a figure. Again, the thing about people like Dole is that even if you disagree with them, their opponents respect them and frequently like them. And that's really important for Democratic politics. You really have to be able to connect with people you don't agree with. And that's such a quality that we have lost in recent years. And even if you have it, you may be politically punished by your supporters, but by seeming too willing to talk to everyone else. And that's to me, one of the most corrosive things we're seeing in contemporary politics. We need more Bob Doles.
I think you hit on something there. If you're going to have a system as we do, I think you have to be able to make a compromise. You know, these aren't academics who are talking about theory. The reality is that it's got to be, you know, like even in my marriage, my wife and I, I want to go see Jurassic Park and she wants to go see Downton Abbey. Well, we've got to make a compromise. Okay, we'll go see Jurassic Park today, but then how about tomorrow we go see Downton Abbey or vice versa, right? I mean, you got to meet each other halfway. And it seems like no one is able to do that anymore, sad to say.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, again, it used to be taken as a matter of faith that you can be ferociously advocate for your party, but when it comes time to get the work done, you better be prepared to talk to people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
A couple of guys that you mentioned, everybody's got their little chapters, Al Gore and John Kerry. Now, you know, the interesting thing was, I think you said Al Gore was the almost president and John Kerry was the patrician. But I think that title patrician could be not only applied to Al Gore, but probably to a couple of others. Governor Bush, McCain, maybe even Romney to some extent. And so I kind of wanted to group all these guys together, maybe leave out Bush, obviously, because he won. But, you know, what can we learn from them? Each one of them probably has a nugget or two that we can learn from.
I like the way you group them together because I agree with you. I think they represent a subcategory of presidential candidates. In fact, they actually harken back to the original pool of presidential candidates, which were men from elite families. You had, you know, in the 19th century, you had really two strains. You had the Adams strain, which was the elite person who goes to, you know, private academies, probably attended Harvard, you know. And then you have the Andrew Jackson type who, you know, are self-made men from simpler backgrounds. And those two types contend a lot in our presidential elections. And, you know, again, being a patrician in that sense, a Democratic patrician is seems like a contradiction. But in America, we've made the idea work because the idea is, yes, they've come from a distinguished background and they had a lot of advantages. But the idea is those advantages lead them to serve the people. That's, you know. And, you know, again, Kerry and Gore were both from those backgrounds where men, if not them, men like them were expected to become president. In fact, there was that kind of, it was not a very inclusive model of the presidency, but there was understanding that for the most part, men who became president would come from certain backgrounds with certain connections and have attended certain schools. Phillips Exeter Academy, Harvard, Yale, the Ivy League types. I mean, the big part of the Ivy League sheen is the idea that come here and you'll be prepared for power. So, but in a sense, they were men they're 40 years too late. In a sense that the country was less willing to embrace the patrician Democrat. And it's interesting in the case of both Kerry and Gore is that the man who they lose to has that same background.
Yeah.
But he makes a point of conspicuously trying to, remake himself.
Yes.
In the Andrew Jackson mold. I'm just a guy from Texas, you know? Rough horn, you know, I like baseball and that kind of thing. I like hanging out and having a beer. And, you know, all that may be true of him, but it papers over his background at Yale and Skull and Bones, the privilege. But yeah, Bush, George W. Bush, Al Gore, John Kerry, they're all products of the same class.
Yeah.
All products of the same class, except that one of them moves himself into the other category, which at that time probably proved to be a winning formula. The other thing is that Gore and Kerry are both very they're both very friendly men, but they don't have that neither of them, I think, had that ease, that kind of, like, you know, that relaxed charm. Bush was able to exude a relaxed charm that Gore and Kerry couldn't. I mean, they were on a private level, Gore and Kerry were probably, again, very nice men, but there was a little stiffness in both of them. Mm-hmm. Gore, in particular, was someone who was known to have a wonderful sense of humor, very dry, but somehow couldn't project that in his public appearances, at least not much, at least not until after he lost. And he kind of relaxed and said, you know what, I'm just going to go for it. And got a bit in on the joke because you realize he came across as stiff. You know, Gore is a lot funnier than Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton had that, you know, way of connecting with the crowd. But Gore is actually, I think, more down to earth. But it's a matter of, I mean, Clinton and Bush both have that connecting with the crowd quality, regardless of how they may actually be in private. Whereas with Gore, I don't know about Kerry, but with Gore, certainly he was much more of, this is someone you'd actually want to hang out with if you got to know him. But he just can't project that as well in the public persona. And that's a real disadvantage. And I felt particularly bad for Gore because, you know, I felt that he had really been raised by his father to become president. It was one of those cases where the father's own ambitions are being channeled through the son, as it was in the case of his opponent. You know, so that made it, it's another element that made the 2000 election very interesting. But that was one of the last elections where those members of that class would be considered the candidates of both parties. I think we saw a drift away from that during the Obama years, and we certainly saw that a drift away from that in 2016 with Trump.
Yeah, definitely.
So I don't know where we're going. I don't know where we're going to be headed.
It's interesting, too, because when you think about it, Gore, publicly not very able to connect, privately, at least as you said, everybody that knows him says he's a very funny guy, very personable. But then you get, you know, like a Reagan, who was known to almost like there was two sides to him, right? This public sunny disposition cheerleader guy. But even privately, though, a lot of people who did know him wonder if they really knew who the real Ronald Reagan was.
Reagan's the only person to have a biographer give up on him because he can't figure out who the guy is.
Yeah.
And that in itself is fascinating. It's as if there's no there.
Right.
Reagan is all surfaces and you know, it's there's no way to access what his inner life must have been like. And his relationships, apart from the one with his wife, are very congenial, amiable, but not very deep. There's no sense of this man having any really close friendships. And that's, well, you know, when you look at the presidents and the presidential candidates, one way of trying to get a sense of them is, do they have friends? Do they have real friends? What are those friends like? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, one of the most interesting things that I think about Jack Kennedy is that he had a real gift for making friends, not just attracting people who were useful to him, but I think he had people whose friendship he really relished. And I think that's an important quality in him. Whereas other people don't have that ability for that kind of intimacy. And I think Reagan, again, is someone who doesn't repel people. But like you said, Teflon. You can't connect with him because your hands are sliding off. It's right. Like, you know. So it's an interesting quality. Hopefully someday someone will try to get a sense of who he was. Reagan could, again, he could project publicly what he couldn't do privately. And many candidates who fail can do it privately. They can't do it publicly. Even Dewey, you know, who was obviously caricatured as being very stiff. Yes. In public, was said to be, you know, again, on a personal level, he was an interesting man to know and a good friend to have. But that side of him never really got shown during the election.
All these guys are just, I'm so fascinated by these guys. And we've been talking to Peter Shea here. His book is Man in the Arena. It's a fantastic, fantastic book. I suggest everybody check out the show notes page. We've got a link there to Amazon. You can pick it up and check this book out. It's really good. I don't know what else to ask. There's so much here we could discuss this for hours and hours and hours on end, but we don't have hours and hours and hours on end, and the listeners are gonna be shutting us off if we do that. So unless you're Joe Rogan, and I'm no Joe Rogan, so in many ways. But once again, the book is Peter Shea's Man in the Arena. It's a really nice big book. It's very easily digestible. It's not dense. It's got great photographs. You guys did a wonderful job with this book. I love it.
One correction. It's actually in the arena. It's in the arena. And it comes from a Teddy Roosevelt speech.
That's right.
It's a Teddy Roosevelt speech. The funny thing, it's one last point.
Sure.
A lot of history buffs know that quote, the in the arena speech, but they don't know the title of the speech from which it came.
Yes. So share that with us.
Which is Citizen in a Republic. And the core idea of Roosevelt was that, you know, republics, unlike other forms of government, need people who can take risks. Because we cannot have a passive electorate. You have to have people who put themselves out in the public arena, even at risk themselves, in order to be seen and heard and to contribute. And you know, in a non-aristocratic society, you need ordinary people to do that. And therefore, when people try and fail, they can still be inspirational.
That's right. And that's in the book, and it's very good. I think you guys are going to love this. It will make a fine addition to your bookshelf. I know I love seeing it right there. It's great. So, Peter, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us about your great book. Thank you so much.
And, I appreciate it, Sean. Thanks.
Yep. And okay, guys, so like I said, the book is In the Arena, as I screwed it up a few minutes ago.
That's okay.
A History of American Presidential Hopefuls. There is an Amazon link for y'all in the show notes page on the website. And you can go and get this. It will be one that you will really enjoy. And that's our show for today. So thank you very much. And we'll see y'all next time. Do you like the sound of the American History Podcast? My audio production is provided by the Mad Octopus. Check them out over at madoctopusmedia.com.